Okay, so let's start with a fairy tale. Once upon a time, in provinces far, far away, I was a lean, mean, unshaven, carefree whitewater paddler. I have this little block of wood in my office. It sits on the window ledge, and that's what it says. I've mentioned it here before. The older I get, the better I was. It's a gift from Corrine. and it helps me not take those kinds of things that I just said too seriously. That's important for lots of reasons, not the least of which is that living in the past isn't generally helpful, and it can easily become just really sort of pathetic. And so Corrine helps me to, you know, not go there. But just so you know, that everything that I just said about myself in the fairy tale was not just a delusional, sort of adjusted for personal preference set of memories. I brought along some pictures, okay? So, do you want to leave the room, honey? I saw the oh no, it was silent, but it was like, oh no. Yeah, I planned all this before I knew if Corrine was going to be here or not, and then I thought, I'm not going to unplan this, I'm just going to warn her. Anyway, so here we go. Those were my lats. I know, hey? You can't tell it's me. It could be any guy, you know, ripped guy sitting on a rock by a waterfall, but it's actually me. Anyway, let's keep going, because the unshaven part's also true. That's what happens if I just let the thing go, except now it would be like, look like Santa Claus would be white as could be. Anyway, you know, there was some white water involved. So it would be much closer to the facts. You can leave that one up because it's a fave. It would be much closer to the facts to say that I did spend a few years messing around in boats, and whitewater paddling was part of that. It would also be true that I was leaner then, and that just tends to be one of the logical byproducts of having hardly any income and living outside pretty much full time. You know, you just get skinny, right? So that's how that goes. But along the way, I did learn some things about fluid hydraulics, and so these days, those things that I learned about fluid hydraulics, doing all that paddling, mostly helped me to imagine something spiritual rather than navigate something physical, which was sort of the point of all of this. That and trying to keep an image-saturated group of humans sort of interested, right, with something that doesn't feel like the end of the world. So there was sort of a double whammy there. But here's where I wanted to get to. So next picture, if you would, Jody, we'll just leave the rock star paddler out of this. So, Lowhead Dam. Fascinating stuff. Hopefully it will be. So this is a diagram of what's called a recirculating wave. And in this case, it's caused by a lowhead dam, which is sort of a classic structure that we would make as humans to adjust the water level in generally smaller creeks and rivers. They're not very big. That's why they're called lowhead dams. They're not like a hydro dam. Lots of them are actually really little. They're like a foot or two high. But they're a perfect line, generally. They're a perfect straight line across the current of the river. And when the current flows over that straight line and falls down, it has a bunch of energy it has to get rid of because it's falling. It's speeding up. And so the way it does that is it circles back on itself, what's labeled backwash here. So then you get a recirculating wave, all right? So that's why it's called a recirculating wave. Just leave that one up. We're going to actually work with that image for a bit. What's important is not that it's a low-head dam. That ledge can be formed by anything. It can be a rock. It can be a crisp underwater ledge. But basically any straight edge that the water flows over and falls like that will create that kind of a wave, potentially. What's important for our purposes about that diagram this morning, though, is the little humanoid in it, the little figure that's going around and around and around. Tragically, this particular diagram was sourced from a news article about a child that drowned in a lowhead dam. Not an uncommon story, unfortunately. They don't look dangerous because they're small, but that wave, that recirculating motion is very, very powerful. I want to use it as a metaphor. And when I use a deliberate or more extensive metaphor here at the table, someone usually comes afterward to tell me where it failed. So I just want to preemptively say, I know. Okay? I know. I know this one's going to break down at some point. That's actually part of the illustration about our limited ways of knowing. You can come and tell me afterwards what makes you feel better, but I'm way ahead of you. Okay? That's all I'm really trying to say here. Okay, so here we go. The little tossed human is us. And how we got into this place may be very significant in our personal journey and story, but it's not actually what I'm poking at this morning. I'm touching on what it feels like to be exploring what we believe and feeling churned by it, trapped by it, not moving forward. Maybe we're panicking. Maybe we feel like we're never going to get out of the spin cycle. That experience. And that experience can be especially acute if our spirituality was formed in systems designed to perpetuate the idea that that system had a corner on the truth. That that system uniquely knew the way to either avoid spiritual dangers or traps or to get out of them if we somehow found ourselves sucked in there. And just to keep more than one idea in the air at a time, I also want to connect this to our ongoing exploration of some of the possible intersections of Christianity and Buddhism and beyond that to other faiths. So these things are kind of all at play, at least in my imagination, going into this. I also want to let you know what motivates me personally in this exploration, which is not necessarily terrain I go into, but I believe that if we're going to get out of the churning that we often find ourselves in these days, this experience of being knocked over again and again by differences in religion and ideology and race and culture, never mind new viruses, we're going to need to find not a better theology, but a better humanity. They're not disconnected, but they're distinguishable from one another. We need to find ways of being with one another that are characterized by mutual kindness and compassion. We need to figure out how to create new stories that feature mutuality and hope and that generate a renewed sense of I'm for you and you're for me. Stories that help us to imagine how to make a more compassionate and a more sustainable world. If we're gonna get out of the spin cycle, I think that's stuff we have to do. Back to our recirculating wave for a moment. You can see that at the bottom of the recirculating wave, at the bottom of this churn here, there's a set of arrows, and they're just barely visible on the bottom of the screen in this diagram, but they're arrows that go through and out the bottom for you left of the screen. Thank you. There we go. There, those ones. That is where the current flows through and out. Now, if we were standing on a riverbank looking at this wave, like we've got an impossible cross section here, right? To illustrate the hydraulic. But if we were standing on the riverbank looking at that wave, that part, the current that flows through at the bottom, would be invisible to us. We would see the churned up part, we'd see the foaming, frothing whitewater part. White water is white because it's full of air. It's spectacular, but it is not especially solid or buoyant. If you paddle a boat into it, it doesn't hold your boat up very well. Your boat sort of has to sink through it till it hits the not churned up air before it stabilizes. And it's that foamy, flashy, loud part of the wave that's the part that will keep us stuck there in this kind of a wave until we drown. It's the invisible part, it's the deep part, it's the through current part at the bottom that is the way out, that is the way forward. Anyone who has, if you're somebody who fears water generally, you're not going to like this next illustration. So just a little, not necessarily a trigger warning, but a heads up. If you hang around with whitewater paddlers at all for any amount of time, you're going to hear some story like this. You're going to hear a story about someone who was paddling. They got sucked into a recirculating wave, which are also called keepers or souse holes. They got lots of nicknames. If you're a paddler, they get sucked into one of these things, and you can play in them too if they're not too big. Like, there's techniques you can use to go in there on purpose and fool around because it's a really neat space, albeit a little hazardous. But you will hear a story of somebody who got into one that was too big, that they didn't intend to be in, got knocked out of their boat, and got stuck in there. And they were just getting, they were the little figure, the little humanoid. They were just getting churned. And because they were wearing a life jacket, the life jacket kept lifting them up to the surface of the, and they got another breath, and then the recirc sucked them back down again, and then back down again. And eventually, the story will go something like this. Eventually, they had enough presence of mind to remember that the way out was at the bottom, but their life jacket wouldn't let them go there, and they unzipped it. It went down and out. I am not recommending this in telling this story, but you'll hear that story. That's how that dynamic works. Going to the place, to the deep current that we need to get flushed out of the things that keep us stuck on spin, sometimes requires something as counterintuitive as taking off your life jacket at the very moment when you feel like you're drowning. Let me illustrate that from my own religious tradition of origin, Christianity. In 1994, Pope John Paul II wrote a book called Crossing the Threshold of Hope. I'm going to quote directly from that book as an illustration of something I regard as a problematic Christian idea. I'm doing that not to be critical of Catholicism in any way. I think when I read the quote, you'll recognize this is a broadly held idea in Christian belief systems, not just by the millions of people that might think that the Pope is something of a spokesperson for Christianity. So I'm quoting this because it's been widely experienced, not to be critical of it in any sort of specific subgenre of Christianity sense. So here's a quote. Christ is absolutely original and absolutely unique. If he were only a wise man like Socrates, if he were a prophet like Muhammad, if he were enlightened like Buddha, without a doubt, he would not be what he is. He is the one mediator between God and humanity. Close quote. If you grew up around a branch of Christianity, anything like the one I did, you might recognize something familiar in the argument that's presented in that little paragraph. And if you could see it in print, you would also recognize some of the values and prejudices that are in its written form. So, for example, it has air quotes. It has quotes around prophet and around enlightened. So it calls into question. That's what those quotes mean in literature. They mean that word doesn't mean what you think it means. So the way the quote is written itself calls into question the idea that Muhammad should be regarded as a prophet or Buddha should be regarded as enlightened. So that's present in the quote as well. Standing back and examining an idea like that one, this absolute uniqueness, the way it's presented here, that can feel, that exercise of standing back to look at that idea, that can feel like taking off your life jacket when you feel like you're in danger of drowning. It can be really hard to pay attention to a voice that says, dive deeper, when there's another voice that is screaming, you already know where the oxygen is, go there. So maybe this is as good a time as any to point out some of the limits of the metaphor. When I suggest that what we really need might be encountered if we dive deeper, am I suggesting that we have to leave a particular tradition in order to do so? Lots of folks that taught me would say that moving away from this idea of the exclusive uniqueness of Christ is not just moving away from Christianity, but actually imperiling my eternal soul. Don't get me started on the origins of the idea that we possess an eternal soul. That's not an eternal idea. Like we can clearly see in the history of human thought where that idea emerges. So that's interesting in itself. But where this gets super interesting, at least to me, is here. And we'll get further into this as we go. But if we dive down even a little ways into the history of the tradition in which that quote stands, the history of Christianity, we'll quickly see that the deeper, more enduring current within the tradition makes room for that maneuver of unzipping your life jacket and diving deeper into that idea, that it's actually present in the tradition. To put it another way, within the very tradition that says don't move away from these ideas or you'll die, there is a substantial history of thinking about big ideas about God, Jesus, and Spirit in more than one way. It's built in. But we have to look for it. So let's take, for an easy-to-look-up example of that claim that I just made, let's take, for example, the notion of the Trinity, of God as triune. It's an idea that first bubbles up using the language of Trinity in the second century Christianity. But when it first emerges, it doesn't sound like what we might know if we grew up around Christianity. As early church father Theophilus of Antioch is sort of the first known occurrence of this idea with that word attached to it. But Theophilus defines Trinity in the second century as these three parts: God, God's Word, and God's Wisdom. Now, to Theophilus's credit, God's Wisdom is Sophia. God's Wisdom is the feminine, the divine feminine, which is fascinating. That didn't survive patriarchy, but that's where it kind of emerged, right? So that's three parts. So it's Trinitarian in that sense, but it doesn't sound like what we think of as 21st century Christians. That's not the formula. That's not the language, right? That language comes a century later. Tertullian, well-known church father as well. In the 3rd century, Tertullian offers the first doctrinal defense of the idea of Trinity as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So we're 300 years in to the thing we call Christianity before the idea of the Trinity, as we now think of it, is even on the radar. That's important. And it's important that Tertullian writes about his own doctrinal defense of the Trinity that most of the believers around him really didn't like it. They took issue with it, and they pushed back pretty hard. They just thought that was a bad idea. It's fascinating. Given how many Christians nowadays might readily say that if you don't believe in the Trinity, you're not a Christian. And all of that just scratches the surface of the history of just that one illustration. But it can serve to help us see that religious ideas that get treated like sorting machines for who believes and who doesn't are not almost ever as robust as they might appear. So, to come back to this piece from John Paul and his statement about the uniqueness of Christ, here are a couple of things to think about. To engage with these might mean sort of unzipping the life jacket of the idea that Jesus is unique in a way that dismisses other possibilities, and diving down looking for older, deeper currents. And as we've seen, that's not a new thing to do, even from within the Christian tradition, never mind from outside of it. So here's the first idea. Simply stated, Christianity can be understood as a multi-faith tradition. Christianity can be understood as a multi-faith tradition. If we look at the history of the thing we call Christianity in the 21st century, it is a synergy of large aspects of Judaism mixed together with sort of some baptized elements of other ancient religions, particularly in terms of its overall shapes, ancient religions that go back to the Egyptians, and sort of other pagan traditions. I'm going to call those that into question myself. Mixed in and sort of all sort of blended around and adhered onto the figure of Jesus Christ and what he brought into the world. That's, if you sort of stand back from the thing a bit, that's what you find that it's constructed out of. Now, you could look at that kind of religious history and use it to be dismissive about Christianity, to go, well, if we can see that that's the case, then what is this? Like, who needs to care about this at all? You could just blow it off. And lots of people do arrive at those kind of conclusions from that sort of exploration. However, it is also possible to look at that same information and understand it in terms of a teaching from within the Christian tradition itself, which is that whatever we call God is something that we see dimly, something that we squint at, that we see through a fog, as the Apostle Paul writes. And that's just true because of the humans doing the looking, the humans doing the making of the ideas. We can hold whatever we believe with both passion and humility, but not if we think about an idea like exclusive, the way that Pope John Paul wrote about it. That's the life jacket unzipping part, right? When we've been told, perhaps our entire lives, we'll talk another time about what happens inside of our brains when we get an either-or idea when we're children, because that's pretty significant stuff too, and it can actually equal significant trauma. But especially if the idea sorting says you're gonna suffer forever if you get this wrong. So that idea that something is exclusive in a way that dismisses other things and makes them impossible, that's the life jacket feeling. I've got the right idea. As long as I'm zipped up in it, I'm not going to drown. The idea that we need to unzip it and go deeper to find the current that flushes us out, that's the thing that's hard to kind of get around sometimes. One other perspective, just to at least briefly make the connection back to our study of Buddhism and Christianity. Thich Nhat Hanh, a Zen Buddhist, much published in the West, who regards Christ and Buddha as equal partners in his own spiritual practice, says it this way. He's commenting about that particular statement that I read from Pope John Paul. This statement, the John Paul quote, Hanh writes, does not seem to reflect the deep mystery of the oneness of the Trinity. It also does not reflect the fact that Christ is also the Son of Man. All Christians, while praying to God, address him as Father, Of course Christ is unique. But who is not unique? Socrates, Muhammad, the Buddha, you and I are all unique. The idea behind the statement, however, is the notion that Christianity provides the only way of salvation and that all other religious traditions are of no use. This attitude excludes dialogue and fosters religious intolerance and discrimination. It does not help. The way I was educated, I'm supposed to dismiss that because it came from a Zen Buddhist monk. Having spent a little bit of time with Thich Nhat Hanh's writing, I read it now as someone whose respect for Christ as a spiritual leader. I don't know how one might measure these things, but I often have the sense that it certainly surpasses mine. I read it differently because of that. To put what Nhat Hanh says here in other words, that attitude, attitudes that exclude dialogue, foster religious intolerance and discrimination, those are the things that are going to keep us stuck in the spin cycle of I'm right and you're wrong. Rather than freeing us to dive deep into the ancient current of seeing even the biggest ideas we might have about the divine in more than one way. And when we can do that, we can get flushed out of the toxicity of conflict and into the sunlight and the life-giving oxygen of exploration. We can breathe again. Not just get a gasp and then get flushed back into deadly spin. I think that's an important idea for us as spiritual explorers. I think it's an important idea for us under the current cultural circumstances as well, because it equips us to think about other people's experiences in ways that are open-minded and open-hearted. And I think that's pretty important stuff.